Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Just kidding there, guys. Jacob Byrne here from StyleCulinary.com. And we're going to answer some more of your confit questions, I think, if I can find them. You'd think I'd be prepared for this stuff, huh? Professional broadcaster Jacob Byrne here signing on. Can't find the questions I was supposed to answer. Oh, no, I have too many browser windows open. Somebody help me. Okay, I was joking, but now I'm serious. I have no idea where I'm at right now. What the hell is going on here? I'm sorry. There we go. Okay. Thing is, I have to have like 50,000 browser tabs open for all these pages of questions that I have here. So let me scroll up and see where we are at. We are on the confit thread. And I'm just going to warn you, I'm coming into these questions cold. So put your bullshit detectors on. Just kidding. You can't stump me. Because I'll just tell you I don't know. Okay. Jay Weinstein. Damn, forgot it was your weekend. Sorry, mate. Just ignore me until you're back in action. Yeah, no worries, bro. I've been sick. So, yeah. What should we talk about on the other oil thread? Okay. So now we are... So we're talking about oxidation here. And so Jay Weinstein drops on into our confit thread, and he says, okay, does this oxidation issue mean freezing may be the best way to guarantee freshness? Yes? Kind of. We'll talk about that in a second. If wings lose their freshness on second and third day, will freezing maintain this freshness? Ah, okay, I see what you're saying here. Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about best practice in a second. How long do frozen wings last? How many days post-confit does oxidation and warmed-over flavors occur? So technically, once you cook a meat and expose it to oxygen, that warmed-over flavor process begins to occur. Just like, you know, when you stick a piece of protein in your fridge, you already have the bacteria on that protein to make it spoil. There's just not enough of that bacteria yet, so it takes time. Same thing with the warmed over flavors. So just had a brain fart there. I can't even like remember where I was going with that. Okay, yeah. So here's the deal with your warmed over flavors for your chicken wings. Basically, after you cook them, so you want to, you know, it sounds like you're pretty serious. I have a really nice chamber vacuum sealer. We're not really nice. It's like not like an expensive one. But so I have the VacMaster. I think it's the P215 is the model number. I get it here stateside. It was like $800. And that thing's a boss. And quite frankly, it's a little on the small side. So if you can spring for something larger, you know, I'd go for that. But it works really good, and it has it's an oil pump, so it lasts a pretty long time. You just need to make sure you change the oil periodically. You just look at the manual. But the chamber vacuum sealer works really well. So what I would do if I were you, so say you want to get ahead on your fried chicken wings, what you would do is you would pick whatever initial cooking step that you like for your first cook of your chicken wings. Then you're going to want to chill your wings under refrigeration. Make sure they're completely cold. Here's two interesting tips for you. So why you would want to chill them, because we're going to chamber vacuum seal them, right? So one of the reasons why you want to chill them is first they're going to freeze faster because we're going to freeze them after we chamber vacuum seal them. So there's going to be less ice crystal formation like we talked about in some previous discussion. I'm losing track now. But also too, when you're sucking air out of that chamber, basically what you're doing is you're creating a vacuum, which means that there's no atmospheric pressure inside that chamber. And then when the pressure is released, the bag kind of shrinks tight. So what happens is just like when you climb an altitude and you have less atmospheric pressure, if you place warm wings or just a warm food product into a chamber vacuum sealer and try to seal it while it's still warm, as that air pressure, as the atmospheric pressure drops in that chamber vacuum sealer down to almost nothing, then the boiling point, or the point at which the water within the wings of the food that you're sealing is going to lower quite considerably. You know, so you could even get it as low as like 120 degrees Fahrenheit. So that means that the moisture inside the wings is going to start to boil, and you have you'll have moisture loss and you know, all sorts of things that go along with boiling wings. So, digression, but I thought you'd find that interesting. So you want to par cook your wings, however you're going to par cook them, chill them in your fridge, then chamber vacuum seal them, and this is going to allow you to store them in your freezer for a couple of months at least. And it's going to keep the ice crystals from forming. So then what you could possibly do is work out a system to where your wings are par cooked perfectly. Now, you want to do what's called an IQF, which is individually quick frozen, and the quick part doesn't really apply for most freezers unless you have like a blast freezer. But you want to lay the wings out individually. So if you have a walk-in freezer, this is going to be real helpful. You can just put them all on a sheet tray rack. And you want to freeze them individually before you vacuum pack them, and that'll keep them from sticking together as one solid ice block. And then once they're all individually frozen all the way through, then you take those frozen wings and you vacuum pack them, and then you pop them directly back into your freezer and you hold them. And so what you could do is you could have, so if you're doing like, you can pre-portion them. So say your normal order of wings is like 12 orders. Well, you just do, or 12 wings, you just do 12 wings to a bag. And then you could get to a point where you're working them directly out of your freezer, and test that. Which again, you're going to have to test it alongside the ones that have never been frozen, and then you know, maybe magically the wings that have been frozen are better. Maybe they're not quite as good, but they're so damn close. You know, you don't think it's going to be an issue, but it makes it more convenient and you don't have as much waste or food loss because it's all frozen and working out of the freezer. So those are decisions that you're going to have to make on the operations end of what's best for you. But yeah, so you can par cook them, freeze them, and then possibly work them directly out of your freezer. If not, then you can, at the very least, just pull enough chicken wings for the next day, every single day. So before you leave the night before, you pull enough chicken wings from your freezer, put them into your walk-in refrigerator, and let them thaw overnight. The next day, you have enough wings, plus some in case you go on a big run for the next day. So that's another good way to work it out. And doing it that way, you're probably not going to have much, if any, quality loss when comparing frozen and fresh wings. And then, okay, Jay Weinstein, freezing damages proteins through ice crystals, microscopic cuts. Yep. Does this apply to par-cooked chicken wings? Yeah, it applies to everything, but it's not going to be as major in chicken wings. We'll talk about that in a second. Would par-cooked chicken be less affected when frozen? No, not necessarily. Jacob, damage caused by freezing occurs during thawing. Yep. Does this mean that frozen to fryer is best? Will this prevent a crisping? No, because technically, so you're still going from frozen to fryer. So the damage is already done when the wing is frozen, because that's when the ice crystals form. So then thawing it doesn't really affect it. The damage is done. You just don't notice that damage is done until the wings are thawed, because then you see the weeping. So with chicken wings, you know, which are technically a little bit of a tougher cut of meat, you're not going to have as much issues with texture from frozen, because you kind of want to break down the texture of that wing anyways. That's why we're doing the par cooking, to break down the collagen and stuff. Now, don't go getting all crazy on me and saying, well, what does this mean that if I, you know, just freeze my chicken wings, I don't have to par cook them? Nope. The mechanisms are completely different. Let's just assume for now that the thing is because a chicken wing or a chicken leg is a little bit more sturdy than, say, a fillet of salmon, then you're going to notice you're going to notice a more drastic change in fish that was once frozen, because it's a more delicate flesh, than a protein that was once frozen. And this doesn't mean that you can't freeze your fish, But if you don't follow best practices like chilling it down completely first and vacuum packing it and then freezing it, you know, then you're gonna notice a little bit of a slight difference. That's why fresh fish always tastes better than frozen fish texturally, and you know, so like we talked before, you could technically work, you know, figure out a way to work those wings directly out of your freezer, which could be convenient and really good for like execution and profitability. But going from frozen to like done is, you're going to have to work out some kinks that I can't help you with. You're just going to have to, you know, do some trial and error, maybe set your fryer at a little bit of a lower temperature, all sorts of stuff. But you can definitely freeze your wings, then thaw them out overnight every day. And that's a good approach too. And then you would still vacuum pack the wings per order. So if you're, you know, again, a dozen wings per bag. And then you would say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to sell, say, 50 orders of wings. So I'm going to pull out 50 of these, you know, one dozen bags and then thaw them out. And then you keep those, you know, chilled on your fryer station. And then when your cook gets like three orders, you just open up and you rip open three bags. So then once those wings are thawed in the bag, they're going to actually hold a lot longer too. So they're going to stay nice and fresh, and because there's no oxygen, they're not going to get any more warmed over flavor since they're already par cooked. So it's a real efficient way. Just, you know, three orders of wings, you open up three orders of bags, already thawed, pop them into your fryer, drop them in, boom, you're well on your way. Okay, and then Jay Weinstein, you follow up. Jacob, I'm not sure where you're getting that information from, but I would assume that most of these places are not doing single fries from fresh. That would be my assumption, yes. If I had to guess, I would say that they're either ordering in frozen wings that are already par-cooked, or they have a prep team par-cooking. Yep, that would be my guess. And then Jay Weinstein, you say, honestly, Wingstop preach it in all their videos. They use fresh, etc. So... here's the thing. I went and I did. So let's see if we can pull some stuff up here on Wingstop. Yeah, you know, here's what I think they're doing. They're saying, hey, we get in fresh wings, you know, or we order in fresh chicken wings that aren't frozen. Which is, quite frankly, a mute point, because just because the wings aren't frozen doesn't necessarily mean they're of high quality, right? So I think what they're saying, you have to realize there's certain buzzwords that register with consumers, and it's a business. They're trying to market. So in the United States, do you know what free-range chicken is? So when you say free-range chicken, it's like, oh, this happy chicken, like out on this farm, you know, scratching in the dirt and hunting bugs and, you know, running all around on the grass. Like, oh, free-range, I can feel good about eating this chicken now, you know? Well, technically, by law, the legal definition of a free-range chicken is a chicken that has 2 square feet of space and is exposed to sunlight or the outside atmosphere or the outside air at least once before slaughter. So you could literally keep a chicken in a 2-foot-square cage its entire life, walk it through a muddy pasture on your way to the slaughterhouse, accidentally drop that cage in the muddy pasture and be like, oops, oh, my chicken cage is all muddy now. Isn't that cute? Then pick up that muddy cage, walk it to your slaughterhouse, kill the chicken, and then slap a free-range label on it. And then the uneducated consumer at the supermarket looks at it and goes, oh, hey, free-range. I'm a good, responsible parent. I'm not going to feed my kids a bunch of poison and feed them a bunch of, tortured animals. I'm going to feed them happy animals. I'm going to feed them free range. So I'm going to buy this free range chicken for twice the price, and I'm going to feel good about the chicken dinner I cook tonight. So my argument is Wingstop, I guarantee you Wingstop is doing some sort of double cook. They are not doing it from fresh. I can almost guarantee that. What they're doing is they're ordering in fresh wings, and they're saying, hey, our wings are fresh. Now, I could be wrong. Go ahead and feel free to link me to a specific video, but I want a Wingstop source. I don't want some guy saying, hey, this is how, I don't want some, like, you know, chump in a YouTube video in his home kitchen being like, this is how Wingstop makes their delicious chicken wings. I'm going to show you how to do them. And like 29 of his techniques are flawed. And, you know, so if you can link me to a specific source for Wingstop frying from fresh, then we'll discuss it further. But I really honestly believe that they're ordering in unfrozen wings and they're using the word fresh as a marketing gimmick, as an adjective. These are a lot of videos on YouTube which show them cooking. Okay, so you said there's a lot of videos on YouTube which show them cooking from fresh. Please send me a link to that, because I couldn't find any when I was looking for them. Grant, your point, pressure frying required in training. One of these days, going to catch you out. I'm never posting a question on that again. Yeah, so the pressure fryer thing, I mean, it's all about execution, man. You got to look at, like, it's, you know, because once you develop a recipe, like, unless you're a one-man show and, like, a food truck, and even then, eventually, your goal should be able to pass off some of that, you know, some of that cooking to your cooks, because that's what you do as a chef. You know, you gotta look at execution and, like, you know, how realistic is this approach? And there's certain things that I do in my restaurant where, quite frankly, there is a better approach to doing it. However, I don't believe the trade-off is worth that extra time. So a good example is this. Sous vide lamb rack is awesome. It's very, very good. Okay, I like sous vide lamb rack. I have no problem eating it. I have no problem serving it. However, I believe that lamb rack is one of the few proteins that is actually better and has a better texture when it's traditionally pan roasted than when it is sous vide and then seared, because specifically how the fat cap renders and how that crust forms. And I like having the difference in texture from the outside in on a lamb rack, and you can't really replicate that with sous vide. Trust me, I've tried. So technically, the sous vide lamb rack is inferior to a perfectly pan roasted lamb rack. However, in Stella, on a sold out night when we're busy, I'm not going to rely on my line cook, as good as he is, to 100% of the time perfectly pan roast a lamb rack to mid rare every single day, day in and day out, 5 days a week, you know, 50 weeks a year. Okay. You're going to have a lack of consistency. So for me, the trade-off is this. Technically, the pan-roasted lamb rack is better, but the sous vide lamb rack is pretty damn good, and it's way more consistent. So that's what I mean by, like, creating recipes and then looking at the operational side and taking into consideration, like, what's it actually going to take to make this consistent? Because the one-word answer to what makes a restaurant consistent is or what makes a restaurant successful, gave away my punchline, consistency. That's it, okay? There's tons of shitty restaurants out there that are very successful because they're consistent, okay? Look at all the chain restaurants out there, okay? They're not good restaurants, but they are consistent as hell. Their decor, their service, the way the servers greet you, you know, their food, their mediocre food, their crappy food. So every time you walk into one of these restaurants, at least you know what you're going to get for every dollar you spend, okay? So consistency is massive, and you need to make sure that you work that into your operations side. And as a home cook, too, that's very important. Consistency is very important. So make sure that when you're developing a new dish, you're developing something that you can, you know, practically execute, and it's not going to put you in the weeds or not going to make you sacrifice the rest of your meal. Okay, barbecue player, you're up next. Hey, Jacob, is this not your weekend? How cute, you guys think I actually get a weekend. Anyways, I'll just fire away. Let's see. Did you go to some type of school or college? Surely hands-on experience wouldn't give you all the specific backup. I'd imagine they wouldn't have the time. Honestly, so I went to a culinary school, pretty well respected in San Francisco. However, I'm not going to name names because it was garbage, straight up. I worked in some really nice kitchens for some really good chefs, but, you know, and that was just more to see how they run successful restaurants. But if you want to be a real food G, it's all about constant learning, never stopping, always researching what other people are doing, finding your own voice in the kitchen, and you know, traveling down your own paths, questioning everything. Always. You know, not just saying, okay, that's how it's done because that's how it's done. But, you know, you know, just why? Like my daughter, you know, she'll run me in that why circle. Daddy, why is the sky blue? Well, you know, because there's a lot of nitrogen in the sky, and nitrogen reflects blue. And why? Why is there nitrogen in the sky? Like, you know, five questions down the line, I'm about ready to explode. But with that same curiosity that my five-year-old daughter, you know, views the entire world that she's just now starting to really explore and understand, is the same curiosity that you should view cooking if you really want to get the most out of it and really want to be, you know, be a real player at it, you know, barbecue player. So yeah, question everything, get yourself some good science books. I recommend starting with, On Food and Cooking. That's a really good place to start. And then, you know, go from there. Reading Google Scholar online. So, you know, look for research papers because, you know, there's a bunch of chefs out there who, you know, are saying, hey, you know, do it like this because that's how it's done. And then there's actually guys that are like writing doctoral theses on like the lifespan of freaking oil. So you go, you pull that up. You know, if there's some chemistry terms that you don't understand, you Google the chemistry terms and then you just kind of trudge your way through it. And the more you do it, the easier it becomes. And you start seeing the same technical verbiage used over and over and over again. And you start to learn how to speak the language of food. And once you learn how to speak the language of food, then when you start searching out new information, number one, you know the right questions to ask. So your searching becomes, you know, it doesn't take as long, becomes much more efficient. And then when you find the right answers when they're in their technical form, you can then understand the language in which they are speaking to you. And then by understanding that, you can then ask the appropriate follow-up questions if need be and then continue your journey down the path. Okay. To get into your question, you say, Jacob, okay, so I asked you, what do you mean by clear gelatin? Clear gelatin is like the pale gelatin. The article was about roast chicken. Basically, the lesson was more tan the gelatin, the better the flavor of the gelatin. What they're probably talking about there is the Maillard reaction. So, you know, you brown meats because meats taste, you know, yummy browned. Meats that are poached are going to have less of a flavor. So if you have some of those brown particles in your gelatin from the roasted chicken, it's going to have the same flavors. New rule, though, okay, because you guys are referencing a lot of other websites or articles that you're having me kind of debunk. If you want me to address those, you got to post a link, okay? So just say, hey, this article said this. What do you think? Post a link because it's unfair for me to answer that question where maybe you misunderstood the article or maybe it was taken out of context or whatever. So for everyone to drive their knowledge for, but basically what they're talking about is brown meats taste better than unbrowned meats, okay? They're going to have a more robust flavor. So brown gelatin is going to taste better than clear gelatin. In that sense, okay. Jacob, concentrated juices are culinary gold. Yep. Does gelatin add a unique texture to sauces such as gravies? It does. It adds a mouthfeel, most definitely. And that's why when you do a full reduction sauce, like I demonstrate in my sauces and soup video index, the full reduction sauces are kind of like the king of like all meat-based sauces because you're not using starches to thicken the sauce. You're actually using the gelatin from the stock to thicken the sauce, which means you're going to get way less of a yield because you basically have to keep on reducing your sauce until it's thick enough to you know, lightly coat a spoon, which we call nappe. But it's going to have a much more intense flavor and a much better mouthfeel. And if you reduce that sauce really far, then you get like this like sticky, like gelatinous mouthfeel in your mouth. Which sometimes if you take it too far is unpleasant. But so gelatin will affect mouthfeel. It'll also give body to soups and stocks. So it is important. Is this related to melting point and greater consistency at higher temperature? Is this related to its melting point and greater consistency at higher temperature? No. So really it's more because gelatin's melting point is pretty much our body temperature, okay? And technically, it's not our body temperature. It's the average body temperature of the animal from which it was taken from. So like beef gelatin and pork gelatin have slightly different melting temperatures, but they're pretty much negligible. So fun fact for you. But what it is, as you reduce the water out of your sauce, so you know that water in your stock is evaporating in the steam and the atmosphere and escaping your sauce. The gelatin, as well as the other particles in that sauce, are going to start to concentrate. The gelatin is going to give your stock body. All the flavor particles are going to start to make your sauce more flavorful because they're not diluted by the water anymore. And that's how you get a really badass full reduction sauce. And then barbecue player, gelatin storage. I'm getting gelatin during testing, but I just throw it out. Oh, shame on you. Working two jobs in between this website and Facebook. Ain't got time for sauces yet. Dude, just do yourself a favor and freeze it. What's the best way to store gelatin frozen? What's its shelf life in the refrigerator? About a week. Is it possible to freeze gelatin? Hell yeah, freeze it, bro. Will it take on a negative result from freezing? Nope. And here's what I would do if I were you. So you take that gelatin, right? And you can do this with stock, too. So I like to if you have a second, you know, you get home from work, you got that gelatin, throw the gelatin in a pot, crack yourself a beer, turn that pot onto a simmer, come back and check it in like an hour, and like, you know, and basically you're just reducing it to concentrate the flavors even further, okay? Pour that into ice cube trays, pop it into your freezer. Once they are, you know, the next day when they're solid ice cubes, you then take those solid ice cubes, you pop them out, pop them into a Ziploc bag, pop that back into your freezer. Next time you're making a sauce or making a soup and you want to add a little flavor bomb, kabam, throw in a couple of ice cubes straight from that freezer bag, and people will love you for it, okay? So, yeah, don't throw that stuff out, man. It's way too good to waste. Holly, WTF, I was thinking about Stella today during lectures. Just realized I'm going to ask less questions so not to annoy you. Nah, Holly, come on, let them fly. I'm going to keep it to the important ones. The one below is super important. Storage life of cooked chicken. I've always heard that the holding period for cooked chicken is always 3 to 5 days. Would you agree? Yeah, but so if you're serving, this in a commercial setting, going past the 3 day mark is not going to be good for business. Now, if you're like, if you're at home and you don't feel like cooking and you got like a roasted chicken that's been in your, in your fridge for 5 days, and you want to eat it with some rice and just like pop in your microwave and fill the belly and not worry about getting sick, then yeah, a 5 day old cooked chicken is going to be fine in your fridge, but you're definitely going to notice that there is some flavor loss. So if you're just making it for yourself and you don't mind the flavor loss and, and all you're worried about is getting sick, then yeah, 5 days old, you should be good to go, assuming that it's, you know, stored in a good refrigerator where it's, you know, not a bunch of fluctuations or people are always constantly like opening the door. But yeah, if you're going like, if you're after, I mean, really, it depends, but I would be uncomfortable serving chicken after the 2 day mark. If people were paying me for it in this context, however, and that's because of warmed over flavors. However, I will make my chicken sometimes last for, 7 to 10 days when I vacuum pack it raw, cook it sous vide, chill it, and then hold it in that vacuum pack where it's completely pasteurized before I then retherm it, sear it, and serve it and charge people $30 for it because it's the best chicken breast I've ever had and I'm serving it to them in a fine dining restaurant. So it's all about oxidation like we talked about and warmed over flavors. So if you're cooking something sous vide and you're not cutting it out of the package, you're definitely going to get some more shelf life on it. But if you're just loosely wrapping it in plastic wrap after it's cooked and you pop it in your fridge, then you're going to have issues after a couple of days just with flavor loss. So if that's true, is it related to holding time or is it related to the storage time? Yeah, mainly storage time. So so after 5 days, you're kind of taking a risk of like traditional storage of it like being unhealthy to eat because, again, it's not in a pasteurized bag like when I sous vide it. So, yeah. I hope that answers your question. So if you're just going like the traditional method, after 2 days, par cooked proteins in general, you're going to start to notice a flavor loss. And with beef, it's even more rapid to where like if you cook a steak and then you try and reheat it and serve it the next day, it's going to be no bueno. Vacuum package extends storage life. Yep, I just talked about this, so maybe I should have read your comment more completely first. If the confit wings were cooled down and then vacuum packed, would that increase their shelf life in the refrigerator? Yes, absolutely. As discussed, chilled cooked chicken loses its freshness gradually as it's held in the refrigerator. Would vacuum packed cooked chicken be at the same optimum point on day five as day one? Yeah, pretty much. And also, too, bonus points for actually, if you're doing confit and you have a vacuum packer and an immersion circulator, then that's a good argument to do your confit in the circulator, because then you don't have to ever worry about warmed over flavors. Now, this doesn't mean that you're going to have an unlimited lifespan on your chicken wings. You're still going to want to serve them within 5 days because even though they're technically kind of sort of pasteurized, you can still have some bacteria in there that grows, mainly botulism, and you don't really want to be messing around with botulism. So, but if you're doing, you know, if you're par cooking your wings confit and you have an immersion circulator, which I recommend everyone buys, it's, you know, you spend lots of money on tools in your kitchen, you know, screw that, you know, really expensive pan or even that really expensive chef's knife. An immersion circulator will change your life. You can get a good home unit for about $300. Just make sure you get the circulator type that, like, circulates the water, not the water oven type that doesn't, like, you know, actually circulate the water. Look at Anova, one of the two. But they're good. So what you would do is you would vacuum pack the chicken wings in the bag with the fat, and you cook them either at a low temperature, like we were talking about, to get like the less traditional sort of you know, dense, chewy, but not, like, you know, too chewy texture that I like. Or you can cook them at the higher temperature, 185 degrees Fahrenheit or 85 degrees Celsius, and that will give you more of a confit texture. And then you ice them and chill them while they're still in the bag. And then when you go to cook them later on, you can cut them out of the bag. Now, the problem is you're not going to have them – you're not going to have their skin dry out, right? Which is going to lessen your ability to crisp it. But it's something else that you can test. So I kind of got off track there a little bit. However, so you're still, for chicken wings specifically, you're still going to want to let them be exposed to air overnight in your fridge, because you got to get that dry skin like we've been talking about this whole time. But after that day one, if you then took those chicken wings and vacuum packed them, you'd be able to preserve their flavor. However, now that they're in a moist environment, you may not get as crispy a skin. You're going to have to test that. I don't know. And I mean moist environment in the sense that they're not exposed to oxygen anymore, right? So they're in a vacuum bag. So the internal moisture that's left in the wing is going to eventually diffuse out into the skin. Yeah, I mean, really, I still think the best way to do it is just to keep your chicken wings, you know, par cook them, let them hang out in your fridge for 1 or 2 days, and just try not to let them go past that. So it takes a little bit of planning time, okay? Can salsa chilies gravies be vacuum bagged? Yep, absolutely. I know your experience is all in high end, so fresh is best. However, with the exception of sous vide, do you have much use for vacuum packing? Oh, yeah, absolutely. So chamber vacuum sealers, you can do like compressed fruit, which is awesome. But so check it out. We make, you know, one of the secrets to, so the secrets to like high end fine dining is it all comes with prep, right? And then being able to execute it. So we spend hours and hours prepping every day and every week, and getting everything set up and ready to rock. So we're not doing anything on the fly, right? So I have an artichoke heart velouté, and I also have a, cauliflower puree that are on the menu right now. So I make those in big batches. I chill them down, and then I vacuum pack them in individual vacuum packs. I do about 2 quarts to a package. And then we just stack them in our freezer and freeze them. And because there's no oxygen and because they're liquid, they freeze very, very well. There is absolutely no flavor loss whatsoever. Then, you know, every single day, I pull just enough for that day. So it's at its optimum freshness every single time I buy it, even though I might have made that sauce 2 weeks ago, right? It's at its optimum freshness because right after I made it, I chilled it down, vacuum packed it, and froze it immediately. So it didn't have a chance to oxidize or sour or anything like that. So I freeze it, and then that day, I pull out just enough sauce for that day, and it keeps my sauce very, very fresh, and it keeps me from having to make that sauce every couple of days. And then I always leave that those sauces a little bit under seasoned because the seasoning and the flavorings will change slightly just over time as the flavors meld. So I'll season with, so like my scallop puree, or excuse me, my cauliflower puree that I use on my scallop dish. I'll put that in the pan, heat it up, reduce it down a little bit so it thickens a little more. Do a final seasoning with salt and a little touch of vinegar, a little tiny bit of sugar to balance the acid if I need to. Taste it and then serve it. So absolutely, vacuum packing sauces, soups, gravies is a really good way to go. Frozen vacuum packs. So if I let wings air dry in the fridge for one day to ensure crisp skin, vacuum pack them after one day, then froze them after vacuum pack. So I would reverse that. I would freeze them first and then vacuum pack. Does it sound like a way to ensure wings are always at optimum point? Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Does vacuum packing help extend their life while frozen? Absolutely, because you're going to have less freezer burn over time. Does vacuum packing help maintain their optimal quality while frozen? Yep, it absolutely does. Okay, Rob Sue, you're up next. The only way to prevent these warmed over flavors is to cook and chill in a vacuum bag without breaking the seal. Yep, that's a good question, Holly. Will vacuum bagging post first cook extend their shelf life in the walk-in, then push it past 3 days? Yes, but again, so the reason, let's think of the reason why we have those wings in the walk-in in the first place, exposed to air, right? It's to dry out their skin so we get optimum crisping. Now, what we're doing is, so we're just creating a gradient, basically, of moisture. So there's still interior moisture inside the chicken wing, right? So as the chicken wing is exposed to air, that skin is going to dry out, which is going to allow it to crisp better. Now, when you take that skin or that chicken wing with the dry skin and then put it in a vacuum bag and store it, the skin is no longer exposed to air. So now the internal moisture in the wing is going to slowly diffuse into the skin. Now, in the sense of it being frozen, right? So if you dry it, if you let the chicken wing sit overnight in your refrigerator, and you get that dry skin, and then you freeze it, that water migration won't occur anymore because the water is technically locked up in ice. It's going to be solid, right? So this is just my theoretical approach. I'd have to test this to make sure it's actually correct. But so you might be able to get away with freezing the wing after you've dried out the skin overnight and then vacuum pack it and then possibly, like I talked earlier on, work it directly out of the freezer, which would take some adjustments. Or at the very least, thaw them overnight and then maybe just open the bag and drop it directly in. It may affect the crispiness of your skin. I don't know. There's concerns there. And honestly, you would have to test to make up your mind. So, but yeah, vacuum packing will stop the oxidation, which creates warmed over flavors. Are vacuum machines expensive? Is it one of those pieces of equipment where you can't buy the cheap, modestly? So again, I've had mine for a couple of years. $800. It's the VacMaster P215 or something like that. Just look up the 215 model. And it's really good. I wish it was a little bit bigger, but it serves my purposes. And then, you know, you can get a really nice, like, larger model for like $2,000, which honestly, for like, when you talk about savings and like product loss and storage and all that sort of stuff, I mean, once you get a chamber vacuum sealer, like, you'll be like, man, if this thing ever breaks, I'm gonna be screwed. So it's definitely worth an investment for sure. Is vacuum bagging cost prohibitive? Are the bags expensive on a day to day basis? Are the bags reusable? High electricity costs. So no, not high electricity costs. The bags are not reusable, and the bags can tend to get expensive, but not that bad. I don't want to misquote you what I pay per bag, but we bag almost everything. Like, every entree protein that rolls through my restaurant is bagged, either in groups or individually, depending upon the application. And it's part of my, I call it Q cost, right? So what I do is there's certain costs that you put on your food costing sheet that you have that aren't necessarily, associated with that recipe, but they are associated with the food. So a good example of this is like, if you have like ketchup bottles and like mustard bottles and paper napkins on your table or salt and pepper shakers on your table, those are all things that aren't associated with the food costs of an individual recipe, but they're still, but you have to have those costs there to serve your food, right? So I have what's called a Q cost on my food costing sheet that I set at 1.5%. And what that does is that charges, so when I'm doing my calculations in Excel, when I put in all my hard costs, like what my food costs me, you know, and then it multiplies the food cost percentage that I budget, I have an additional Q cost in there, which is 1.5%, which says, okay, so for every dish I serve, I'm going to charge an extra 1.5% to cover things like my vacuum bags, the, you know, when people request salt, when people request a sauce on the side, whatever, you know, I'm going to, so I have that worked into my sheet. So that might be something that, that you want to look at with your vacuum bags, and see how much that's going to cost you each month. Let's see, is it unusual for a vacuum pack machine to be in a normal one-off diner? I thought it was either for big mass producing chains or really upmarket fine dining places. Yeah, but I mean, that still doesn't mean that, I mean, the wave of the future is guys who understand cooking running simple diners, you know, like, so like, man, I'll tell you what, we do diner food for family meal all the time, or like what we call like American classics or white trash food or whatever you want to call it, you know. And but because we have this technology at our hands, you know, like it would blow any diner food out of the water because we're using immersion circulators. We're using our chamber vacuum sealer because we're comfortable with that sort of stuff. You know, we're using our induction burners to control heat and, you know, doing full reduction sauces to serve along with our chicken wings, you know? So, chamber vacuum sealers are good for any business that deals in food. Just like immersion circulators are good for any business that deals in food. And once you learn those technologies and how to use them, you're going to have a massive advantage over everyone else in the area, you know, all of your competition. I started using sous vide technology 5 years ago when I first got here at Stella. There wasn't a single other restaurant in this entire area that was using sous vide technology, and it immediately gave me a massive advantage over everybody else. Immediately, my proteins were always perfect. They were coming out faster. They were easier to execute. They tasted better. They were more tender. They were more consistent. And it gave me a massive, massive advantage. And, you know, and I would have like, chefs and sous chefs at other restaurants and be like, man, I wish we could get an immersion circulator, you know, but they're just so expensive. I'm like, bro, how much did you spend on linen last month? You probably spent $2,000 on linen last month, but you're not willing to spend $1,000 on immersion circulator, which is going to make sure that every single steak you send out is perfect. You're nuts. Get your priorities straight. So yeah, that's my take on that. Okay. Rob Sue, by the way, when you hit Stella full time on the 19th, I'd be more than happy to repost everything that I posted under this relevant thread. I'm sure everybody would too. Chef Jacob, to hold the wings at 140 degrees, you'll need to fill the chamber with the steam setting, which will introduce water to the skin of the wings, which will keep them from reaching their full crisping potential. You can test it, but my guess would be that you'd be disappointed with the results. Yeah, so you're quoting me when I say that, when we're talking about holding your wings at 140 with your CVAP. Okay, I think I get you. Let's forget 140F. Let's say I'm frying to finish and wish to hold for service. So I'd have to hold it at about 145F. Yes. As you know, the combination convection and steam, heat and humidity, works so well with breaded products like fried chicken, etc. Are you saying that the naked skin is a different ballgame? No, I'm not saying that at all. That in order to keep it crisp, you would have to use convection heat only, that you cannot use the texture setting. Yeah, so you'd have to use the texture setting. But to my understanding, so when you asked your original question, I was thinking you were saying, well, can I just cook the chicken wings, bag the sous vide in my CVAP, and then hold them at that temperature and then, you know, pull them directly out and then fry them. And my contention was they would be, the skin wouldn't be dry enough, because part of what allows you to hold at a really prime temperature, or a really exact temperature, I should say, is the fact that the wings have very, is the fact that the humidity in the box is helping to convey that temperature or that heat, because humidity or moisture is much better at conveying temperature than just dry air. All right. So I think it would be a better approach to actually fry your wings crispy, like you're ready to serve them, and then just hold them in your CVAP. And you basically do enough batches of wings to maybe get you through like the next 20 or 30 minutes, or to get you through like your rush. And you can pull the wings directly out. You would sauce them real quick with a hot sauce, put them in the plate, and then serve. That would be my approach. Also, too, I would call the guys at Winston Industries. I've talked to them on the phone a few times. They're the makers of the CVAP. They're super, super chill people, very knowledgeable. So call them and ask them, because they know their machinery better than I do. And I'm sure they'd be able to send you down the right path. And tell them that Jacob Burton over at Stella Culinary is a really big fan of what they do and always talks about them on his really super cool podcast. And they should send him a free unit to test. Let's see. As you know, are you okay? CVAP has food temperature dial. Yeah, so talk to them. Jay Zuckerberg, you're up next. Interesting. I assume internal temperature was not relevant to traditional par cooking. May I please ask you this question again? I think you're basically saying the following. When you par fry at 250, 275F, internal temperature is relevant. Internal temperature is always relevant, regardless of what you're doing. Okay. Protein should be pulled when desired internal temperature reached. Example 140, 150F. Yep. Internal temperature should not go above 150F. Depends on what you're doing. But yes. What about pasteurization? 15 seconds at 165F, 30 minutes at 140F. Yep. Those matter, because you don't want to kill people. So if you par fry for 15 minutes at 250F, time is not long enough for pasteurization to happen. If you pull the wings, well, it depends. So it's all about internal temperature, right? So if you par fry the wings at 250F after 15 minutes, if the wings have not been at 165 degrees Fahrenheit for 15 seconds, then no, pasteurization has not occurred. The wings are not cooked through and they're not safe to eat. If you pull the wings at 150F, 15 seconds is not applicable. Correct. But basically, you're still going to be cooking the wings through. So what you're talking about here is the traditional par frying at 250 degrees Fahrenheit. So your step with that isn't necessarily to cook the wings through. It's to render some of the fat from the skin and to make the wings tender to eat, and then you later go and crisp them. Okay. But internal temperature always matters. Wing size, chewy versus dry. How relevant is size of wings to chewy versus dry? As sous vide is controlled environment, does sous vide work the same irrespective of size of product? Yes, it does. It just takes longer for that product to be cooked. Now, I know whole chicken would take longer, etc. However, would the variance with regards to wing size not be relevant with cooked sous vide or confit? No. Where it would be relevant, though, so even though you can make it tender, is maybe you have like a preference for like sauce to chicken meat ratio. So on a smaller wing, you're getting more sauce in ratio to the chicken because there's less meat on it. And then on a larger wing, you have more internal meat than the surface area. So as you're, you know, so that's just geeky stuff. So like if you find like, You know, maybe you prefer like a larger sauce to wing ratio, you might want to go with a smaller wing, because it's going to be more sauce per bite of wing. So that's where it would. I normally get in the jumbo chicken wings because that's what I like. Variance in texture. Sometimes I bite into the wing and it could be perfect. Then I might experience the odd chewy part. And as we discussed before, it's chewy because it wasn't cooked through in that area. So you just got to cook your wings longer. Just wondering, can you think of any reason which might lead to a variance in texture? Yeah, just the wings aren't completely cooked all the way through. You have hot spots, cold spots, especially in traditional ovens, you know, so, and the wing is just not, you know, it's possible for one area of the wing to be at a certain temperature and the other area of the wing to be at another lower temperature and not to be all the way cooked through. All I can think of is that half the wing touches the base. That's a good thought. That part of the wing touches the base, is not exposed to the fat oil as much. It's not surrounded. Yeah, so I mean, there's lots of variants. So you're just going to have to try and do even cooking. So yeah, I hope that answered your question there. Let's see. Who else we got? Variance in texture, problem, solution. Okay, yeah. Jay Weinstein, you're up next. Further to that chef link I sent you in the oils thread. Do you, Jacob, or any of your guys and girls have an opinion on the following comment? The only real advantage raw wing offer is appearance, golden brown skin. Actually, raw wings are only juicy immediately after cooking. If you are doing takeout or catering, they lose temp and moisture faster than pre-cooked? Yeah, no, I mean, I kind of responded to that in the oil thread a bit, but yeah, I would say no. Here's the thing. The restaurant industry is very, very large and filled with a lot of people who all have various degrees of knowledge and who all have massive egos. Okay. There are a lot of very, very, very wrong individuals out there that will never admit it because their ego is too large. And the way you cut through that is like, show me the science. You know, show me the science. Why? Question everything. No, that statement is absolutely asinine. This has just baffled me. You know why that baffled you, Jay Weinstein? Is because you are not stupid. And that is a stupid statement. That's just one guy's opinion. So yeah, but there is nothing in my knowledge base or nothing in my logical reality that would make that statement make sense to me. And just the fact that, like, talking about them staying hot longer, it's like, do you somehow, like, break the law of, like, thermodynamics? Like, no, just be quiet, dude. You have no idea what you're talking about. How would a raw wing be juicier initially? You lose its moisture faster than double. I'm not even gonna. Yeah, no. Nope. Okay. So, Rob Sue. Interesting. That means a double fried wing would hold better in a CVAP cabinet than a raw wing. No. I don't know, though. Everybody is an expert on the forum. Oh, okay. You're talking about the forums. Don't get me wrong. Some people know their stuff for sure. Not all, though. Yep, I would agree with that. Not all. Not being sinister, but everybody knows it's true. Don't believe me, and you'll all find out the hard way when you waste months using the incorrect information. Yeah, absolutely true. So here's the thing. Actionable information, straight up. I tell you to go and test. I tell you why you should test something and what your possible outcomes are. And then based upon the knowledge that we're sharing with one another, we can talk more food science-y stuff and say, oh, okay, well, this happened and this is why that happened, because we've done our research, we've looked at the literature, and that's why that happens, and this is how collagen breaks down. And that was our outcome, and now we can explain our outcome. Now let's figure out a way to make it better. And now let's test that to make sure that our assumptions are correct. And, I mean, how many times have you had somebody serve you something that they were convinced was good, and you're like, man, this is hack at best? You know, I mean, you can't tell them that. But it's like, dude, you're serving me a roasted chicken. The skin is hardly brown. It's obvious that you didn't even brine your chicken. Like, no, it's not good. But somehow you're magically convinced in your own little, you know, universe that you serve the best roasted chicken ever. You're out of your freaking mind. Slash and rant. Rob Sue, you go on to say, does 4-hour danger zone rule apply to cooked or raw chicken? It applies to both. Is 4 hours the max time for a cooked chicken? Actually, Lupe, come on in. Lupe. Oh, I missed him. Is 4 hours the max time for cooked chicken at room temperature? Yes, for sure. In terms of second fry, would a room temp wing knock time off your final cook? No, not really. If it does, the time difference is insignificant or something like, say, 30 seconds. Yeah, I mean, you're dropping it in really hot oil. The difference between room temp and like refrigeration temp is not going to make a difference, except with holding the wings at room temp, you're risking a cook maybe like, you know, holding it for, you know, at room temp for too long and getting somebody sick, which is really bad for business. Jacob, when you par fry wings, do you complete your final fry with a chilled wing or allow it to come to room temp first? I always go straight from my walk-in refrigerator into my fryer basket and never had any issues. Also, wings look a bit odd sitting on a counter during service. Would you store them in an airtight cheese tub, etc., while at room temperature? No, because I wouldn't hold them at room temperature. Another crazy thought, what is the max temp you can hold at without any negatives occurring? Let's say it's 110. If held them in a CVAP at 110, the final fry could take like a minute. It would just be crisp skin. Is this a ludicrous suggestion? Well, I wouldn't go that far because I think you're a pretty cool guy, Rob Sue. But yeah, I mean, I think you're kind of overthinking it. I think you just do, a final fry, from refrigeration temperature, and you're gonna be solid. Okay, that's it. We went kind of long today. I appreciate all the questions on this. Now get back in your kitchens and test those ideas. Do not take culinary dogma for an answer. Always, always, always question why. And keep on testing until you get it perfect. That's it. See you on the flip side. I don't know why I always say that. I don't know how to end these things. It becomes kind of awkward. You know, so I think I'm just going to end it.